So when I was initially asked by Alexander to respond to the papers on the panel, I was of course flattered, although when the abstract arrived, I was a little nervous, given the diverse interests of the speakers. How could I possibly comment coherently on pieces by Alec, a historian linguist, David, a theologian, and Katie, a theologian linguist, although of course all three have far more varied scholarly and non-scholarly identities than the summary suggests. However, despite the chronological, geographic, and thematic diversity of the topics, there are yet, I would suggest, strong similarities between them. So I'd like to highlight strands shared by the papers, some strands shared by the papers, which I think are of especial interest before going on to pose some questions. The first strand, I would suggest, is identity, particularly concepts of what makes a legitimate identity within a group of people. In all of the cases highlighted, this has arisen from a polarisation of ideas of what it should or should not mean to belong to a particular group. Such absolute positions are certainly apparent in Katie's account of the Tea Party's interpretation of the American Constitution and its apparently erroneous additions on the topics of slavery and immigration. In David's analysis of footnoted sections of recently published Bibles that attempt to mould and maintain a particular theological and political identity, and Alec's discussion of the representation of pirate radio and its audiences in the 1960s. So whilst identity then seems a fairly straightforward point from which to start, I'm keen to recognise the subtlety of the papers and the ways in which such concepts run through them. Across all three, key ideas are outlined and allow us to see how concepts between seemingly incomparable themes, Reformation Protestantism, recent developments on the American right, for example, are transferable, and clearly say something about a bigger picture into which these analyses fit. For example, David's assertion that in contemporary American Protestantism, as in that of earlier centuries, true interpretation of scripture comes only from the de novo interaction of reader, text and spirit, seems remarkably similar to Katie's conclusions regarding the Tea Party's view of the Constitution, which I'll paraphrase here as the basis of and rationale for life in general, with no context or historical schooling necessary. And she makes clear the potential links between the Tea Party and biblical literalists. I'd like to suggest, though, that David's paper opens up the possibility to see the links going beyond a literalist minority and into the heartland of American Protestantism. But whilst the Protestant Reformation sought to undermine and contravene traditions, readings and interpretations of Scripture, so too do members of the Tea Party seek ostensibly to undermine the authority of elites and to return the Constitution and its interpretation to a pure state. I could go further, but I'll conclude this section with David's comment that global capital is using Bibles to create readers with a very narrow historical memory and a very definite ideology. If you replace Bibles with Constitution, the parallels, I think, are fairly clear. Mm. Different forms of media and different texts may become vehicles, tools, for rather similar political ends. Relating to the political, the idea of neoliberalism is, of course, raised quite briefly by Alec, but is also applicable to David's paper, and I'll return it if I have time to this idea in a couple of moments. In addition, the papers give insights into the varied uses of historical narratives outside the academy, and it's useful to be reminded how and why the past is important to people other than university historians, mainly. Sometimes seems like a surprise. Katie's consideration of the responses of Tea Party members to questions about American history demonstrates how the past, as conceived of by the Tea Party and its opponents, is a battleground and a recognised stumbling stone for the unwary politician. Hence the need to develop a particular rhetorical mode to negate criticisms of apparent ignorance. The biblical past too is open to a variety of interpretations, as David demonstrates, and offers another area of contention and rhetoric, however unreflective and ill-informed this may be. Perhaps less contentiously, although no less interestingly, Alec's discussion of the representation of British pirate radio stations, their stereotyping, the manner in which they're frequently used as a foil to the boring and staid Britain of the 1960s, suggests the usefulness of such modes of representing the past for television producers as well as politicians and kind of other capitalists, and is suggestive of the ways in which the British past is manipulated in order to offer a Whiggist version of history with improvements made to cultural life, despite this being rather less convincing in reality. Further, Walter Benjamin may have suspected that the erratic power of objects would be reduced through their reproduction online or in print, and certainly his argument that multiple copies of a work of art means it loses its aura which, as you will be well aware, which he links to the master's ability to bring things closer spatially and humanly, fits to some degree with Katie's analysis of the Tea Party agenda. Although I'm not convinced that the original, in this case the Constitution, would be perceived to have lost its power. However, the argument of the Tea Party that they are non-elitist fits with their ostensibly offering the Constitution to everyone, claiming, like early Protestants, that the text lies well within the ken of everyday people and shouldn't be left in the hands of official or elite interpreters. A variety of scholars have identified the effects of non-elite, often identified as non-scholarly, interpretations of various historical periods and sources. So, for example, we could look at Maurice Halifax's assertion that legal documents, like the Magna Carta, but in this instance the Constitution, establish a relationship between the image of a place and a document, allowing the collective memory to recover the remembrance of legal rights at issue there. Clearly, for members of the Tea Party, legal rights are at issue when additions to the Constitution are under question. And this rigidity forms part of their group identity, as they effectively claim to stand in for the document's original authors, remembering its true meaning on behalf of the nation, and despite the quote that Katie used, which strongly suggests that Locke wasn't the intention at all, that it was a malleable, to some extent, a malleable document. Andrew Hoskins, too, makes points pertinent to Katie's analysis. The shortening of temporal horizons he sees as part of the mediated age are very much apparent in the dehistoricisation of both the Constitution and the Tea Party agenda more broadly. If the media do indeed construct a view of the world as a perpetual present, then this is exacerbated through the activities and interpretations described, whilst being rather similar to the interpretation of biblical passages discussed by David. In all three papers, using Hoskins' term, the past is rendered untraceable, disconnecting past and present and replacing the former with a mediated version offering little, very little in common with actual events or texts. Here, Wolfkanstein's assertion that the audiences of representations with subversive, this is the audiences having subversive interests, are rarely considered, is a useful point. For whilst all three papers consider the potential effects on the audience of the version of the Bible or US history or 60s cultural and media history being offered, further research into the effects of the representations would give fascinating additional insights. As Kanstein puts it, the rare combination of social relevance and intellectual challenge, and I think all three papers have offered this. For all three texts, Bible, Constitution, and documentary film or film footage, offer what Jan Aspen called cultural memory, reusable texts and images specific to a society serving to convey its self-image. So the Bible and US Constitution may be used in this way by particular groups seeking to reject elitism while effectively just creating a fresh form. And arguably film footage too is often used in documentaries like those referred to by Alec in order to offer a Whiggist interpretation of a nation's past and contrast literal images of the Dour and Dull Britain of the 60s with notions of a liberal, non-elite Britain in the present day, which suggests the opposite is the case. So to conclude, you'll be pleased to hear my necessarily brief response and give other people a chance to ask more coherent questions, I'd like to return to Kanstein's assertion that memories are at their most collective when they transcend time and space. If so, all three papers have outlined key examples which are relevant to the present day, although in different ways. I find some aspects of the papers particularly intriguing and offer some questions for their authors. I'd be particularly keen, for example, to have a sense of readers' responses to the versions of the Bible discussed by David, to see if the strong, very strongly worded assertions about communism, for example, are accepted, rejected, or lead to further thought on the part of the reader, or readers, of course, or a plurality of readers. Relating to the idea of the representatives of big business making money from texts arguing for far more egalitarian approaches to living, I'd be very keen to see how those attending groups to discuss Constitution, for example, or reading the original unadulterated version of the Constitution online, conceive of their behaviour and how they relate it to their religious identities as well as their political identities. Alec has raised the issue of the neoliberal subject and considers how consumers of radio programmes and related technology fit the model of the neoliberal subject offered by Andrew Barry, by which culture has become consumer product. So it seems pertinent to ask how neoliberalism might fit into interpretations of the Bible offered to readers in 21st century America, if it differs by denomination or publisher, and whether it seeks through an explicit rejection of communism to maintain a neoliberal subject. Returning to Katie, I wonder whether members of the Tea Party would consider themselves neoliberal despite their claims to reject elitism. Although I would also reiterate Kanstein's note of hope. Media representations may be read against the grain of their intended message. So those consuming biblical, historical or constitutional interpretations are unlikely, one would hope, in all cases, to take every aspect at face value. So relating to this, and returning to my suggestion regarding those consuming the texts, I'm reminded of Kansteiner's call that historians need to incorporate media and communication studies modes of analysis into their, I should say, our research. And I do appreciate that all of the papers do so, to some degree. And this is in order to better understand the audience's address, but also, of course, their responses. Thank you. So, can we have questions for the three papers then?
Oh, I would totally warn you.
Well, in response to your question, Aaron, I can speak anecdotally about the reader's responses to Bible footnotes of the kind I've shown in the paper. When I've taught the Bible in class in various contexts, both a very conservative African-American Bible college and also a more sort of highfalutin Research One university, my tendency is that students collapse the footnotes into the text and they don't see a distinction at all between what the footnotes are saying and what the Bible is saying. And in fact, there are examples, even from Vanderbilt, of students plagiarizing almost whole cloth the footnotes from the Life Application Bible, the one that I've demonstrated here, in their exegesis papers. So they use this as factual analysis of the text without feeling the need to cite it.
I just kind of like the idea that somewhere, maybe one person in a thousand might actually start to read about communism. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That whole agreement.
There are a whole series of other sort of rhetorical safety devices designed to keep them from doing that in our culture, unfortunately. So,
picking up on the point that you made, and related to the current response, you used the term magisterium.
Yes.
And I think that was very helpful. I think you gave, in opposition to it, a phrase such as teaching office.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, technically that's how it functions in Catholic tradition, but my thesis is that there's a rhetorical or covert and rhetorical version of that for Protestants as well.
Sure.
That operates through the public.
The reason I found it extremely useful was supplemented by your closing suggestion that there is a narrowing of historical memory, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in everything I've heard, and certainly Aaron's overall response, it seems that what we're talking about is a narrowing of textual memory.
Yes.
If there was ever such a memory at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm particularly struck by the most recent suggestion. In a different magisterium, the only response that one would get from students to this kind of use of footnotes would be hysterical laughter and refutation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's in your most recent comment saying that there are other mechanisms at play which would stop such a response.
Mm-hmm.
We are reminded, here is obviously a slight repetition, of that narrowing of textual awareness. The use of the apocryphal footnote from Tristram Shandy through to Borges,
mm-hmm.
is an affirmation of the reader's alertness to the humorous possibility of the contradiction within the text, deriving from the text, which is another way of collapsing footnotes into text, but an infinitely more creative way of demolishing the iconographic status of the so-called original. What your paper, I thought, remarkably demonstrated was exactly the opposite.
Thank you. And I think Katie's thesis picks up on that as well, and to an extent Alex does too, that the rewriting of these sorts of histories is designed to narrow those things down and to make them much more ideologically clean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I thank you for your comments. That's very helpful. I'm going to look into Tristram Shandy. I haven't looked at that before.
Well, Borges is the more obvious link to your paper,
mm-hmm.
because of his interest, his profound interest in theology.
Yes.
have a question for Alec. Yes. I was surprised to hear about the female version of the pirate radio station. Do you know of any such other existent
well,
national and international?
Radio 390 is the only one that was sort of exclusively that, just absolutely targeted housewives. On the other offshore stations, and it's something I didn't go into because I keep not wanting to get into the whole argument about what exactly was broadcast. Lots of them did have shows during the day that were aimed at housewives, because interestingly, housewives had a lot of money. And so it was absolutely bizarre, so a lot of the advertisers really wanted to pitch to that demographic, whereas the whole image was about something else entirely. And so kind of what I find fascinating about the entire dynamic is that in order to remember the overall sort of gestalt of offshore broadcasting, that had to be cut out.
Okay. A necessary evil.
Yeah. If you look at, especially Richard Chapman's book, Selling the 60s, he points out that Caroline's first schedules actually weren't that much different from what was on the BBC Light program at the time. It was just slightly more of it. And that's the interesting thing. It gets sold now, and you think about it now, is they were offering variety, and actually what they were offering was, well, two things have happened. One, it gets sold as they were offering variety, and yet there's an increasingly narrow sonic repertoire connected with them. So it's variety, but it was really a lot of the same. But actually there was more variety than we remember there being. So it's this very strange dynamic. And that's why it's funny that the sort of the portable radio gets to be sort of the memory jog of that. You don't have to worry about the content as long as you can suddenly focus on, actually it was about having this personal volition device that will get me where I want to be. Which, I don't think I it's a complex point.
I have a question for Kathy. It's kind of following this kind of gendering. What about gendering in the Constitution? It's kind of very special for you to be in a
In terms of what did the inheritance of the Tea Party kind of look like? Or?
Well, there should be a kind of elitist that should be on the head of that, and after all, it should be these that are following with this kind of political economy. Site is beautiful, so I don't care about your health care and so on.
Oh, okay. Well, interestingly enough, it seems, and depending on the polls that you look at, most people following or who consider themselves Tea Partiers are middle-aged white people. And Aaron and I were talking the other day, last night, there's an interview that a reporter is doing, talking about body image, with a woman at one of these rallies, and he's saying, well, what happened? She doesn't have a health care policy, and she doesn't want anyone else to have one. And he's saying, well, what happens if you get sick? And it's this tremendously overweight woman. And she says, well, I'm quite healthy, and I know a doctor, so it'll all be fine. There are just various levels of blinders going on. And in terms of, well, gender, too, you have Sarah Palin, you have now the woman from Minnesota running for president.
Michelle Bachmann.
There are these kind of token feminist figures that the party likes to sort of look at us. We're so progressive, and we have women running for president who will completely undermine any sort of policies that made it possible for them to be where they are. They'll do the same with race. They're quick to claim the legacy of Martin Luther King, who's probably rolling in his grave. And they're quick to cry racism when criticism against their policies comes from somebody white making a criticism about a Tea Party favorable bill who is black. Did that make sense? I don't know if I made it. So the guy, Herman Cain, the presidential candidate who wants three-page bills. John Stewart, the other day, played a clip of this, and he played the clip of, I only want three-page bills because we're too busy living to read this. And so Stewart came back on, and he said, he gave a little jargony spiel for, I'm Herman Cain, I'm running for president, I do not like to read. And that was it. And boy, Fox News and Tea Party, Sarah Palin comes back. He's racist. He's obviously racist. This was a racist claim made against this man. And he was, you know, so there's an interesting play with gender, with race. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers your question.
All right, thank you. I'm sorry, I'm aware of the time, and there's coffee. So if you'd like to, you can run the floor to the speakers then.